Sovereign Christ Bible Fellowship Church of Columbus, Indiana is pleased to present the marrow of the message. We continue in 2 Samuel chapter 1 today by looking at 17 through 27. And I would encourage you to read those verses. Take the time. Understand that it's a lament. And it's an expression of David's grief. In this case, his grief for Saul and for Jonathan and for the armies of Israel and for the nation of Israel itself. But when we say the word grief, most of us know what we're talking about. We've grieved before. Some of you may be grieving right now. There's that first acknowledgement of the pain where grief erupts. Like in verses 11 and 12 of chapter 1, when David got the news from the Amalekite that Saul and Jonathan and the armies of Israel had fallen on Mount Gibeah, Israel had lost the battle and the nation was in great peril, and grief erupted. It poured out of David's heart. I think we know what that's like, most of us. And we also know that you just don't get over it tomorrow. Contrary to what a lot of well-meaning people will tell you, come on, move on, time to get on, time to get busy, time to move on, life has to go on. But grief abides with us. In other words, it stays with you. You've experienced that. It walked with you. It talks with you. It sits with you. It stands with you. It abides for a while, sometimes shorter for some, sometimes longer for others. It's there when you eat. And grief abides when you sleep, often waking ones in the middle of the night with uncontrollable weeping. David is grieving, and now grief has abided with him, and his sorrow has stayed with him and walked with him. Can you feel for him? I think most of us can. If you can't, you want to. You want to feel for him. You read this lament, and you want to feel what David is feeling. And some of us read this lament, and it seems that it doesn't touch our heart. And others of us read it, and there may be something where it really rings true with us. But you have to remember, it's David's lament. And he's writing this lament to the men of Judah, that they would memorize it and that they would hold it to their hearts. But for us, I think the best thing we can do sometimes, that rather than try to say, I'm not getting anything out of it, or I'm not, it doesn't really affect me, but out of love and with compassion, to just sometimes sit and listen to the one that's grieving. And in this case, let's sit and listen and try to understand David's grief and his sorrow. The first thing we see about David's grief and sorrow at this point in time with this lament that he takes up in verses 17 and 18, it says, David took up this lament concerning Saul and Jonathan, and he ordered the men of Judah to be taught this lament of the bow. So the name of the lament is the bow. And it's a thoughtful grief, and that's one of the first things to understand. There is that first eruption where just emotion pours forth, and then there comes that stage, at least, where you begin thinking through, what is the meaning of this? What is this grief for? And it becomes very thoughtful. And David took up this lament, which is a thoughtful expression of profound grief and sorrow. Look at the book of Lamentations. It is a written lament, a thoughtful expression of profound grief and sorrow over the fall and destruction of Israel through the prophet Jeremiah. David chose his words carefully, and a lament is word where words are thoughtfully chosen in order to communicate and express his mind and emotions. And that Israel would feel for him as well, but not just feel for him, but feel with him. It was right for the nation of Israel to collectively mourn and grieve for Saul, but mourn and grieve in a thoughtful way. A lament provides help. It helps the grieving person. It helps those surrounding the grieving person. As they write their emotions and what's on their mind, as they write them down, it causes the mind and the emotions to unite in the person that's grieving, but for those that grieve with them. And it directs us. It directs our thinking. It helps us to know what ought to be done. How are we to grieve? How is this person who is experiencing the pain of this grief firsthand, how then can we grieve effectively with them? It's not all about me. It's not all about being self-serving, but it is about our understanding how we could grieve with the person. I remember the story, the autobiography of John G. Payton, and he relates the death of his wife and his son, the weeks, the months, the years leading up to their arrival at this remote island in the New Hebrides, where 20 years before, the missionaries that came were killed before they even set foot on soil. They had just touched down, they stepped out of the boat, and they were clubbed and eaten. And here we have John G. Payton coming ashore with high expectations, and within a short time, his wife was pregnant when they came on shore of this cannibal island. And within a few months, his wife in labor, or right after she had given birth to their son, died. And within a month, the son that was born, his precious son, died. And there he is, all alone. At least there's no one there that he can communicate with. And there, those that he would see would be those that would be wanting to eat him. In fact, he had to guard the grave of his wife and baby. He buried them together. But his lamentation has helped me. I think it's helped me to learn to grieve better in an appropriate way, not only for him, because he lived 150 years ago, but to feel for people that suffer the deepest types of sorrows, the agony of the soul. Mr. Payton wrote several thoughtful paragraphs remembering his wife, but one line that he wrote has helped me, perhaps more than any of the others, because there's some things we cannot understand. I've never lost a child. I've never lost a wife. But I have grieved. But listen to what John G. Payton says. Let those who have ever passed through my similar darkness of soul, or rather, let me read it again. Let those who have ever passed through any similar darkness as of midnight feel for me. As for all others, it would be more than vain to try to paint my sorrows. Though I cannot understand the losing of a wife and a baby, I can understand that it's a grief that is beyond words. And that only those who have walked that can really walk with him, but I can feel for him. A dear brother in the Lord named Jim Bird wrote a book years ago after the passing of his wife entitled Remembering Linda. He counts the trials and tribulations through this lament. And as he does, he even recalls the night that she died and how devastating it was, though they had had months to prepare. But this lament was thoughtful, and it also provided for us to read it a gospel-centered view of life and death for the believer. It was thoughtful, and it pointed us in the direction of Christ, which I think leads us to our next point. Not only is grieving, there, David has a thoughtful grief, and we could consider being thoughtful in our grieving, but David's lament is constructive, and just like Jim Bird's story, it became constructive to provide constructive grief, grief that should do something. So verse 19 shows us something of this. This is the beginning of the lament. It begins with a mournful dirge. Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How the mighty have fallen. Boy, I tell you, it's something unnerving when you read that. It's unsettling and it's raw, because here's why. I think the words are intended to cause us shock, especially if you were one of the men of Judah who were being taught this, being instructed in this lament. You would read the first lines, or you'd hear, "Your glory, O Israel." And if the teacher said, "You finish the statement," you would say, "Your glory, O Israel, beams radiant on the heights." Because glory and brightness, Shekinah of God, your glory of Israel, the brightness, your radiance is on the heights, but it doesn't say that. David is purposeful in his words. He says, in shocking words, "Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on the heights." Then he says, "Oh, how the mighty," how the Gibborim, that's the Hebrew word for mighty. It speaks of the strong ones, those that were in the height of their strength, the Gibborim have fallen. That's shocking, because you expect the strong to survive. But he shocks us by saying, "The glory, your glory is slain, lies slain on the heights. The strong ones are slain." And there's something shocking, and it's also something speaking of the humiliation and the embarrassment that Israel also suffered. And David's communicating this, and he tells in verse 20, because it's shocking that the strong ones have fallen, he says, "Tell it not, don't broadcast this around. We don't want it to get to Gath," that's a Philistine city. And he says, "Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Please let there not be a report that spreads throughout Philistia." But there would be, because the Philistines would take the news back, and they would shout in the streets, "Dagon, Dagon defeats Yahweh. Yahweh's strength dies with Saul." So they thought when a king died, so did the strength of the God that the king represented. This was written by David in a way to produce a constructive result. He wanted it taught to the men of Judah, the fighting men of Judah. David wanted his men to know the bow by heart and not just put it in their head, but put it in their heart, that they would bleed the remembrance of the disgrace and the shame suffered at the hands of the Philistines. Far from meaning to shame them and tear them down, this lament was intended to motivate them for the future. It was constructive. Here's what you do with this grief that you feel. And he would have a beating in their hearts and coming, bleeding through their pores. This will never happen again. Even today, the lament is used to motivate the Israeli Defense Forces. New inductees to the Israeli Defense Forces go to one of two places upon their induction. They go to the Wailing Wall and the Western Wall in Jerusalem, or they go to Masada, a fortress, an old fortress constructed by King Herod, high in the mountains. And this Masada was a place that was impenetrable. But Rome came against Jerusalem, against Israel, in AD 66, and by AD 72 to AD 73, Jerusalem had fallen, and now they were pushing toward Masada to cause this last fortress to stand, to fall, which had been held by 960 Hebrew men. And the Romans laid siege to Masada for 7 months, maybe up to 3 years, I suppose. But for 7 months, they barraged the walls. They had made their siege ramps. And rather than suffer defeat, once the Romans finally broke through the wall, rather than suffer at the hands of ruthless Roman soldiers, they methodically killed themselves at Masada. And the soldiers that are inducted into the Israeli Defense Forces take an oath to remember Masada, and they say together, "Masada shall not fall again." A lament of history, a point in history where there's great lamentation, but the lamentation is constructive to cause them to remember. I think it would be good for us to remember the failures of many great Christian leaders and churches that have fallen or been reduced to simple structures standing in the middle of a city. And they fell due to various things, the fall of a great minister because of sin, or the fall of a church because of compromising biblical doctrine and the mission that we've been called to do. But may we remember the shame and disgrace and be resolved to live faithfully in life and death, and even say, as a church, this will never happen. And because we're remembering something of the past, a grievous wound in the past that stays so real, lament may bring up remembrance of failure, but it can serve us very well. And it can serve us if it causes us to humble ourselves before our great high priest, Jesus Christ. And if we seek to receive sustaining grace and mercy in our great time of need by remembering grievous events. Our culture faces sorrow and grief in a frivolous way. Funerals become great parties. The announcement that as Christians, naturally, we believe that absent from the body, present with the Lord, but sometimes in our declaration of that, we miss the fact that there are grieving people. I think that as Christians, we can be some of the most insensitive people. Grief is best serving us when it's thoughtful and constructive, but grief, especially for the Christian, should eventually produce gratitude, a grateful grief. We look at David as he speaks in verses 22 through 23. He begins speaking of the prowess of Jonathan and Saul in battle. And he also speaks of the fact that they were lovely and gracious. In death, they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. This is called eulogy. It's good speak. It's good words that he has for Saul and Jonathan. And it's an expression of gratitude. These good words, this eulogy, is an expression of gratitude and appreciation for Saul and Jonathan. And notice that David concealed Saul's failings, and instead he spoke well of the loveliness and graciousness of Saul. And you say, well, David's a hypocrite. Because why didn't David tell of all that Saul had done? I'll tell you why he didn't. Because he left judgment in God's hands. It didn't mean that David didn't have opinions, but now was not the time for him to speak ill of the dead. David concealed Saul's failings, knowing that God will disclose it. We talked about this last week in chapter 1, the first 16 verses. I think what's amazing is that bitterness had not consumed David. He showed in this one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why he is or was the man after God's own heart. And what does that mean? David exemplified some characteristics of God, and that he was forgiving. He held no grudges. He had goodwill toward Saul. But hadn't Saul caused David pain? Hadn't he caused him frustration? Did not David suffer greatly at the hands of Saul? And the answer is yes. But didn't David here reflect the mercy and grace of God through his humble expressions of gratitude and appreciation? Which is more beautiful and which is more godly? Which would you rather be known for? Being gracious and grateful and appreciative, even of those who have caused you pain? Or to be ungodly and remember how much they've hurt you? A lot of people bring that up at funerals, of how awful the person had hurt them. Well, David knew, and he knew Saul was gone. His tormentor was gone. We have to remember something about something Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6, verses 14 and 15. He said, if you forgive men their trespasses, your Father in heaven will forgive you your trespasses. If you do not forgive men their trespasses when they sin against you, your Father in heaven will not forgive you your trespasses. Thankfully, David's heart was in the hands of the Master. And where there's hardness and unforgiveness, you're going to find, if it's even in your own heart, you're going to find a heart that's lacking in the knowledge of God, lacking in the vast in understanding of His vast love and mercy and grace. The Bible tells us, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. And so it's up to God to take care of the failures of Saul, not David. So David, we see here through this eulogy, must have deeply loved Saul in spite of everything. Oh, Saul's hatred pressed on David for years, up to 14 years. It hung on him like a huge millstone, but now that millstone's been removed. David has no reason to continue fleeing from Saul. Saul is dead. And David begins to bloom and blossom again. So I think David helps us to see, to grieve through what we've seen so far, to grieve thoughtfully, to grieve constructively, and to grieve gratefully. How does this challenge you? And finally, grief is personal. We know that. David asked the women in verse 24, he says to the women of Israel, grieve, weep for Saul. Remember how good he was to you. And then there's this pause. Verse 25, he turns his attention. It's almost as though he turns his back on everything else he's said. And you can just see it. And he turns in a personal way to Jonathan. How the mighty have fallen. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of a woman. Now you can see his attention, his love for Jonathan. But be careful not to read anything into this good speak between David and Jonathan. It's popular to make this question, well, were they in a homosexual relationship? I don't believe that for a second. That would be inconsistent with David's life. But I do believe what he's saying is this. Jonathan had consistently proven himself faithful and loyal to David. He acknowledged David's future kingship, David's future rule, 1 Samuel 23, verse 17. And David's grieving over the loss of such an excellent friend who was pleased to promote David's success and serve in a complementary role. I think you got to remember, it's David's lament. He's expressing his sorrow. He knows something of the faithfulness and the loyalty and the promotion that a wife provides in a complementary fashion. And he's saying he was even more fitted for this role of loyalty and faithfulness and complementarianism. It's David's lament, so sit and listen to him, learn from him. You and I both know this. It's hard to put into words what is on your heart. And David has loved much, and he's grieving much. When grief is personal, it hurts, and it's hard to say. It's hard to put into words, but I think he says it right. If we think in terms of this, that he's describing Jonathan as faithful, loyal, committed to David's success, and working in a complementary role, just even as a husband and wife would. So David's grief was thoughtful, constructive, grateful, and personal. Maybe as Christians, we've lived, as rightly so, we've lived with confidence that when we step out of this life, we step into the next life. But maybe we've become somewhat insensitive toward people that do not have this hope. Even people that do have this hope, who finally realize the depths of pain they feel, the grief they have over losing a spouse of 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, or a child in the prime of their youth. We fail to understand and we fail to sympathize. Perhaps we're so good, so well acquainted in our theology that we know what's going to happen after we die, that we forget that there are people that hurt right now. We're quick to have answers. We need to be careful. It's good to remember why we have this hope, and it's good to remember what we're to do with this hope that we have. We have hope because of Jesus Christ and His work. God sent His Son to save a people from their sins. He Himself died. He gave Himself over to death that we would live. And because He raised from the dead through faith in Him, we have life and life everlasting. And because we have life everlasting, we can come alongside others and speak of the hope that we have, but speaking it in a very sensitive and understanding way. I think it would be a beautiful way for us to live as we think about the pain of others. Be thoughtful. Be constructive in that. Be grateful and understand it's personal for them. May the Lord grant you a sensitivity when you come alongside those who are grieving, and may God grant those of you who are grieving today a knowledge and a knowing that you are not alone. Trust in God. Trust also in Jesus Christ. May the Lord bless you and keep you.